All right, welcome back. Already a fascinating conversation with Clifford Kernicom, probing and pushing into the mystery called Morgellons, as are others. And he has found some remarkable things upon which to continue to build research and make new discoveries. Again, if this is a human-engineered issue, I just am amazed at how evil the mind and the intelligence must be behind it. Clifford, I don't have any idea what this kind of a project could be for, would be used for. No idea at all. But it's damned evil, whatever it is. Go ahead, please. You there, Clifford? Well, we may have lost him for a moment there. Let's hang on and find out. Let's see here. There he is. Please call back. My phone got disconnected. So, network, please call him back. Not a surprise. These things happen more often than not. Okay. In the meantime, let me remind you to go to Clifford Kernicom's site. Just click on his name. It's C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, Kernicom.com. There is so much information there. And the homepage, of course, has that classic montage of six photos showing a relatively blue sky turn into a relatively ugly, hazy, overcast day. The progression, of course, of chemtrails over Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1999. These things, I guess, started around 95, 96. So we're looking at 15 years plus and then some. Are you there, Clifford?
I sure am, Jeff.
Okay, welcome back.
Yeah. That was my side, Jeff. It wasn't a spook. That was my generator had a little quirk in it here.
Well, you at least have a generator. A lot of people don't, so
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, so.
All right. What I was saying was we don't know ultimately if this is man-made or not, but it's beginning to look like this syndrome, this Morgellons issue, this fiber, this filament full of goodies could be humanly conceived and constructed. And if it is, I was postulating and wondering, just pondering, what kind of an evil, brilliant mind would be behind such? It's an extraordinary thing, because people who have this issue are living lives of great misery, and many have checked out. They don't want to deal with it anymore. So just on that basis alone, we have dead people, not to mention the fact that we've had no real 100% up front, above board, absolutely clinically, forensically correct autopsies done on any Morgellons victims that I know of yet to date. But please continue, Clifford.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. And we will be talking about that question within the realm of human possibility as we go along tonight. Two more papers to get through briefly then. One is the title is called Animal Blood. And, you know, there's many obvious questions that should have been answered here. It's just a question of, you know, who's going to do the work. But, you know, certainly one of them that comes across in the very beginning as we start seeing what's going on with the blood is this only human blood that's being affected? And, you know, you would think that question would be answered 100 times over and every species in the planet would have been checked by now if there was any kind of systematic approach to this problem.
You would think.
But to my knowledge, it had never been done. I actually just never had the opportunity. You know, I don't have a pet now, and I don't want to be abusive, and I just never actually had the opportunity to get a source of animal blood until recently, till about, I don't know when this one was, probably about 2 months ago or 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. But I did have an opportunity to receive some legitimate controlled samples of canine or dog blood. And I had actually put in that request a month ahead of time, and the folks finally were able to oblige me in January of this year. And so I had two dogs and their blood. And one of the dogs is 11 years old. I know that. The other dog, the age was unknown. But I put this blood under the scope. And the question was, am I seeing these same structures that I'm talking about? This chlamydia-like? And the answer is yes. It's that simple. The photographs are there, very clear, both dogs. One of them, the older dog, appears to be, let's call it more affected by it than the other, but exactly the same pattern that I had just described with human blood of encircling the erythrocyte and breaking down, starting to break down the wall. So this now says, all right, folks, now we're not just talking about humans. And the obvious question is, to what extent does the condition lie, right? And what species are affected or afflicted and this type of thing? Is it mammals? Okay, only, again, there are so many questions. But to my knowledge, this had never been answered, and now that says it's not anything exclusive to this. And actually gets a little bit crazier than that. It's only very preliminary work. We made a brief reference to it on our last show. But there's some work that I've done at a very preliminary level involving food stuff, mainly fruit, and DNA samples from fruit as well as human. And all I can say is the initial samples showed the same kind of structure going on in the fruit.
I don't like what I'm hearing.
DNA. We're at the point now where contamination, actually, the level we're looking at is getting to be refined to the point where contamination actually becomes an issue now, where the lab grade work will need to be done very, very carefully and under the controls to determine kind of species distinction and or different life forms.
What you're saying then is the potential universality of the spread of these items is such now that it's not going to be easy to come up with uncontaminated cultures and other media to do lab work with.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. You know, what I can document here without any question is that the canine blood has been affected. So yeah.
All right. Well, it shouldn't be like you have the time, but let's get hamster blood, mouse blood, rat blood. Let's do mammals, and then let's go into the reptiles, and let's go into the fish, and let's look at some of the other species.
That's right. And then at some point, you're actually going to be looking at the food chain.
I think we already are, in a sense.
Yeah. So that's another paper that's out there. Again, these were all done in January, December and January, right after we talked. And the last one has to now harps back to this EPA situation, Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, your good friends who so many years ago did their job and analyzed that sample for you.
Yeah, or it didn't, as the case may be.
Did
right?
not, and were rather rude about it, to put it
right.
mildly.
So, you know, it's taken 10 years to get to this point, but the method of breaking down this filament is relatively recent. That's only been the last year or so. Through the combination of an alkali, namely lye and sodium hydroxide, and heat. It was learned that the filament structure can be broken down and the internal components can be revealed. So this environmental sample, back to 1999, which was sent certified mail to the EPA, that same sample has actually been in custody all this 11 years. There's not a lot of it, but it's been in custody. And so after this was discovered about access to the filament through this chemical and thermal means, I did run a test. And the question was, well, what if we were to subject this environmental filament to this same chemical and thermal process? What would happen? And so I did that. And this paper is called An Environmental Source. And, you know, I have to say, you know, we're jaded by now. You know, we just are. But if you actually look at the content of what this paper is saying, it's rather astounding, because what it leads to is that not only do we have the reports about what we're seeing and its structures and all this kind of thing, but we actually even have a source for this. And to me, this has sort of been the most, let's call it missed recognition of basically importance, but it's because we have, you know, look what people have had to deal with for so long, and the lack of response. You know, we're at the point now where you can tell us anything, and it's like, well, we know we've been screwed. You know, so people lose their their incentive, and it's
sure they give it up. Yep,
it's sort of sad, but you know, we know in the end we can't do that. So what was done here was, I subjected to that EPA filament to the sodium hydroxide and the heat, and then I cultured it. And, you know, the culture thing is a whole different story. I have four different main mediums that have been used. They started out with an agar culture solid. Then it went to red wine and then it has gone through a white wine, which we'll talk more about, and then I also have a simulated wine. Well, this filament structure, after it was broken down through this means, was placed in the culture medium that had been successful over and over and over with growing the dental sample, same type of filament structure. And culture was attempted. And the question is, what happened?
All right, let's hang on and find out what happened in just a couple minutes, if we can. Clifford, have to take a break. Come right back. Again, just staggering information when you think about it. There's much more to this to come. And through the efforts of people like Clifford Carnicom and Jan Smith and a few others who are really working hard on this, we'll get answers. Will we get answers in time? Is there time, or is it too late? Back with Clifford, hearing things that some of us probably would rather not hear. All right, go ahead, Clifford, please.
Thank you, Jeff. The title of this paper is called An Environmental Source, and it was written in December 14th of last year. Very short paper, but it describes the fact that a culture was made with this environmental source filament, the very filament, the very same material that was sent to the EPA and refused for identification by them. What happened here is that the same growth occurred with the environmental filament as have been grown over and over from biologically based filaments extracted from dental samples. Absolutely identical. Hmm. You know, I'm amazed here as I look at these photographs. Three of the four structures that we are speaking of are here. The only one that's not there is the erythrocytic form. As a matter of fact, the original, even the original EPA filament was photographed. That'll trace back to the very first photographs I did with a toy microscope on those. They're about 100 power or something like that. But the same structures are there. The chlamydia-like structure, the pleomorphic like structure, the encasing filament, and one is about at 300 in the petri dish, so you can see the filaments that are forming. So, I mean, what are you saying here? To me, this was just completely overlooked. But you're saying that you've now identified a potential environmental source for the very things that we're speaking of affecting the biological kingdom on a large scale. What do you need?
Yeah, right.
What do you need?
A large scale, maybe an overwhelming scale, maybe a scale that is going to change life on this planet permanently.
So certainly we might understand EPA's reluctance to do their work for the public welfare on this.
Right, right.
But one of these photographs as I'm looking at this is amazing. And if anybody ever gets to this and you see it's the one that's called the pleomorphic, but the description says pleomorphic, and it's about in the center on the left side. Just, take a look at that photograph, and then take a look at the cultures that we're going to be talking about as we go on here tonight, and just look at the exact match of form between that photograph from the external environmental filament and a culture from that compared to the biological culture, and you cannot get anything more identical. Now, with all of that being covered, the time we have left tonight, I'd try to split up, and I probably should keep the first one shorter than the latter, but split it up between two papers that have been written within the last 2 weeks. One of them, the first, is called Morgellons, A New Classification, and the latter is called Morgellons, A Discovery and a Proposal, which was finished, what's today? Is today the 22nd?
22nd today, 23rd tomorrow.
Yeah, it was finished today. So So I'll try to watch your time here and cover this one, the new classification. I probably need to at least leave at least 20 minutes for that second one. But this paper called Mergellans, a new classification, what was this about? And, you know, I suppose it's one of those times of realization, you know, that we have. And what happened here was you just sat back and you sort of digest what we're talking about tonight. And the question that sort of comes up here is, you know, what is this thing? What is this thing in terms of a life form? Because you have, you know, 11 years and 5 years or 6 years directly, mm-hmm. where everybody is still at the stage of saying, you know, what is this? You know, and they're calling it a fungus and not a fact fungus, and then they'll come up with a name, and then they'll say, oh, well, that doesn't exactly
right.
work.
Right.
And it's like nobody can name this thing after, you know, 6 years. You got to be kidding, okay? There's absolutely no reason in the world that if there was something that could be identified, that it wouldn't be identified by now.
Right, correct.
And we know this on an intuitive level, but we keep trying to look for someone telling us, oh, it's this, and, you know, down the road, somebody will tell you what it is, but right now we just don't know. There's no excuse for that whatsoever. I have put up those photographs for years, and I've said, this appears to be similar to a certain bacterial type. Tell me if I'm wrong or right. The same pattern for years. The work could have been done, and you simply have to accept at some point that the work has not been done. The work is not being done, and there's no indication the work is going to be done at this point. At the level of directness that is needed.
Think of all the university facilities perfectly capable of jumping into this, folks, and ask yourself, how can it be that not one professor, PhD, is not actively involved in this, who hasn't picked this up and wants to run with it? Not one that we know of.
You know, and at some point, you realize it makes no sense. So how do we make sense of it if no one will help us? And so here's what happened. I just sit back and I look at these four forms that we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And then we start looking at the structure of life. You know, we can go to any biology book, in my case, a microbiology book. But we start looking at the structure of life, at the taxonomy, as it's been defined. And we start to ask the question, okay, if no one else is going to tell us, let's learn for ourselves, how could this thing fit? And what happens is, I go through each one of these. And you start with a filament, okay? And you say, okay, well, what makes the most sense? And then you step through the next one, you say, what makes the most sense? And you go through the next one, you say, what makes the most sense?
Mm-hmm. That's called Holmesian deductive reasoning.
Yeah.
Hold on, Clifford, I'm sorry, we have to pause. And we'll hold it right there and come right back. Yeah, just logical deductive thought. When all else fails, use logic. We'll be right back. Okay, gang, a half an hour to go already. These programs with Clifford are just amazing. I hope all of you listen 2-3 times because there's that much important material here. And again, we'll continue to cover this story. I think we're going to be covering it forever, as long as we're on the air, and hopefully people after us will continue until we find out exactly what it is and who did it. All right, Clifford.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. I'm aware of the time, so thanks a lot on that. So I'll probably cut this one shorter, but that's all right. We'll do the best we can with it. Take about 10 minutes. In 1978, you had a person by the name of Carl Woese. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It's W-O-E-S-E. I'm going to use Woese. But you had a person who basically restructured life. It was a mate in terms of the taxonomy, the structure of life was redefined in a way that made sense. And has been eventually accepted at a pretty broad level. And what happened before was you had these kingdoms. They They call them the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom and the fungus kingdom and this type of thing. And when Wells came along, he said, you know, the things aren't really making sense. And, of course, I'm sure there's always questions. Everything has imperfections. But he took a big picture view of life, and he reorganized it. And he said, you know, these kingdoms, this thing isn't really working. But here's what seems to work better. And he reorganized basically all of life into three domains. He uses the word domain rather than kingdom. And so basically there's a simplification that's taking place, and there's also a new type of hierarchy that's been established in terms of that taxonomy beneath these domains. And the three domains that he establishes are the bacteria, the eukarya, and the archaea. I hope I pronounced that middle one right, or the last one right, archaea. But these are three domains of life, and let me give you examples of what's in these three. We have a sense for what bacteria are about. This is one. The eukarya, it's big. It includes fungus. It includes animals. It includes plants. It includes protozoa. Okay, most of the things that we're familiar with, say in the living world, other than bacteria, are in this eukarya, including us. So you know, you have removed that plant and that animal kingdom separation, and they fall under a single domain. And of course, there are criteria that determine these three domains, but the criteria are consistent and they're available. I'm not going to go through them in the book, but they have to do with the type of cell wall, and actually what it came down to primarily was the RNA. It was the genetics of these organisms that established this basis for division. And then the last one, or the middle one here, is our archaea. And this is a very interesting group because this is a more recent knowledge to us. But, you know, when we hear those stories about these life forms that live in the volcanic vents, you know, and underneath the sea, and, you know, extremely high temperatures, completely inhospitable conditions, these are the archaea. These are organisms that can live, you know, off of methane and carbon dioxide in extreme heat.
Got it.
In extreme cold. That is a whole domain by itself. Mm-hmm. In other words, it is of equal status to most everything we know about plants, and equal in status to the bacteria. And the archaea are considered to be the sort of the oldest form of life on Earth, most likely.
And
the
they could be doing quite nicely on Mars, for example.
Yes, that's right. In fact, this is, if you look for what kind of life they're looking for on other planets, it's most likely the archaea. So if you take this three-domain system, which has now been pretty widely accepted, it's in the standard books nowadays, and then you look at what we have here, I start stepping through these things. And you start with a filament, and you say, okay, maybe we don't know exactly, but what's most reasonable? What is it most like? And you're drawn to the fungal side of things, which is under the eukarya side. And then you start looking at these bacterial-like things, and they are bacterial-like, and you say, okay, they seem like they could be there, but you know there's this problem, and that is that these things are extremely resistant to heat and chemistry, basically. Extreme hostility and hostile and adverse conditions, they hold up, and they not only hold up, they thrive. So there's something that's not making sense there, because that form is a little bit more like the archaea, okay? But then by the same token, they have a metabolism that is similar to what chlamydia pneumonia would be like. They live in the cell. They feed off the cell. They have the symptoms of chlamydia pneumonia. So you step through these three of the four, and you're already having this huge split in consistency between existence at the domain level, at the highest level of knowledge of life. You start having these major contradictions and split. And then you get to the erythrocytic form, and it's like, this is nuts, because, you know, this is not even close to being anything in the bacterial world.
Right.
Not anything even close to being in the archaea world. It requires a high-level sophistication, you know, mammalian types support system. And so you're back to the eukarya with this. And so, you know, to shorten this up in terms of what the net effect of this, when I look at this, I say, this structure that we're talking about, it is crossing all three lines of these domains.
Mm-hmm.
It is sharing the attributes of the three, literally that top level of life as it is known. These structures are sharing them across the board. And so you have to ask, how could this be?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I hope that I'm proven wrong in this paper. And believe me, it's wide open. If somebody can prove me wrong, please do so.
Right.
But the logical interpretation and conclusion here is that you have an entity, an organism, whatever you want to call it, that has basically been engineered. This is a perfect demonstration of the height of, call it creativity, as well as indulgence in the arena of genetic engineering.
And arrogance.
To seek out the highest levels of life that one could, and to see whether or not it would be possible to create an organism that would cross these lines. and is it feasible? Is it feasible in your imagination that it could be done? It's very feasible in my imagination that it can be done, because you know darn well that's the quest that's going on in the genetic work, is to cross any line you can possibly get across.
Oh, they've been at that for years, you bet. Yep.
And so this is my conclusion, that the most likely thing that we're actually dealing with, it truly is a new organism. This is why it's not being identified. It doesn't exist.
Was it designed to reside in living forms such as we know them, or was it designed for something else and it got loose? These are questions that are very important and have no obvious answer for. Somebody on the planet put this together. That's a statement, and it is a possibility. It doesn't rule out any extra help, but this is an amazing thing we're hearing from Clifford tonight, and we'll hear more in our final segment already in just a few minutes. Guest, Clifford Carnicom. All right, my friend, we just have about 9 minutes left. Go ahead, please.
I see it coming. Thanks, Jeff. I think at some point we may have to simply accept the reality that, you know, it's not very likely your local health department is going to come and tell you what's happening. And so at some point...
Never happen, my friend, never.
Yeah, at some point you got to put a stake in it yourself and see what you can do. And this last paper, it's called A Discovery and a Proposal. It's put up today. It's a culmination of many months of work, is what it is. My caveats about medical advice are all over the place, so I'm not going to read them. I'm not a doctor. I'm not giving anyone any medical advice ever. And, please don't call me asking for anything regarding treatment or anything like that. It's not going to happen. But I will give information freely, entirely freely, with regard to any research that I can do. And that will be done. And that has been done here. And the issue is this. I have probably worked now with hundreds of cultures over the last few months. There's a lot of work that goes on there that we simply are not going to be detailing here. And it's a very slow and sort of trial by error, and a lot of different things that work there when you're working with these cultures to combine creativity as well as patience and persistence, I guess, and disappointment and whatever along the way. But obviously the need is to control the growth of this thing, and that means both on the plus side as well as on the negative side. Can the growth of this particular organism be regulated, and can we put a stop to it? We know we would like the answer to this, and I'm saying right up front, there's nothing easy about this, and I'm not going to be coming out with any magic elixir or anything here. I can put this stuff in sodium hydroxide, solid lye, and heat it up, and it'll sit for three months, and I can take a single drop out of it and start another culture, and it'll start fresh as new every time. So this stuff is not being killed, quote, killed in any conventional sense by anything that I have seen. When you start looking at that discussion we just had on the domains, and you start looking at antibiotic effectiveness, it doesn't look promising to me there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, who knows where that's going to lead? But this is not an easy game we're in, and I'm sure that's not accidental that that's the case. But what I have been working on over the last several months is to see whether or not one can gain any level of control over the growth of this organism, quote unquote. And possibly any means of suppressing or hindering that growth. Again, we'll be rushed, but I'll try to give 2 or 3 minutes on each side of that equation, and I hope that people will read the paper to see what's happening here and what I'm stating. I think it will be seen that I'm not a person that acts in a mode of despair. I don't care what's going on here. We know what needs to be done. And let's get to it. And I'm doing the best that I can, but a whole lot of work and help is needed. But we have learned a couple of things over these last few months. And one of them has to do with increasing or enhancing the growth. And again, it can get a little bit technical, but I'll try and boil it down to the essentials here. And there are many, many trials that were reached to get to this particular combination or combinations that we're speaking of here. But with respect to enhanced growth, the filament will grow in just about any kind of wine that looks like red wine and or white wine. And it'll grow slowly. It depends on temperature, it looks like, but you can have a range of several weeks, even months involved to getting through the filament stage. And so the typical thing is that you'll see those early stages. Remember, we went over those four stages. It's the bacterial-like forms that are of most interest to me because these show up first.
Mm-hmm.
Those bacterial-like forms, you can see those within, say, a week or so in these wine cultures. That's roughly that type of thing, maybe a week or two. Every time you have a cycle like that, whether it's a week or 2 weeks or 6 months, then that takes time. And we don't have years, so at least, you know, I've been doing what I can. At that rate, it's going to take us years to make any progress, and that's been the case for a lot. I've been working on this for some time. Well, call it accident, call it luck, call it intuition, call it whatever you want, but there is a particular combination of things that appear to rapidly enhance the growth of this organism. And the basis of it would be a wine culture, so you can start looking into the chemistry of that and learn what's going on there. But then there were a couple things that were added. One is I've been working on the question of iron quite a bit, whether or not there is an involvement with iron, in the use of iron in the metabolism. So iron sulfate was added into that culture. And, you know, that has some interesting effects, but it wasn't dramatic, but it's still a part of the research that I'm doing. There was the additional introduction of hydrogen peroxide, just a couple of drops, in combination with that iron, in combination with the culture, in combination with the wine, and a rather dramatic reaction does take place. The growth explodes very, very quickly at the bacterial-like stage. I'm at the point now where within probably 2 hours I can produce that bacterial-like growth.
Really?
Repeatedly. Without any doubt, the same forms that we're talking about under the microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And so a huge advantage in terms of the turnaround time, that's one. I've also switched over to white wines that are working clear solutions because that's also been a hindrance here in terms of seeing. So now we can see better, we being me, I suppose. I can see better, and it's just basically a lot easier, and it's more controlled than it was. All right, you have this rapid expansion of growth that takes place. The question that comes up is why and how? What is going on? Now, again, it'll be a summary statement, but there's a very interesting chemical reaction that's known. It goes back to 1894. It's called Fenton's reaction, and it has to do with peroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and iron alone. Forget the culture right now. Just look at the reaction called Fenton's reaction, and you'll see that the combination of the iron ion and hydrogen peroxide will produce what is called a hydroxyl radical. Now, what can be said? There's a statement on there. You know, what's the deal? Let's see. Here's a statement. I'll get it on the record, and then we can dissect it over the next few months.
Okay.
The statement is this. Given that a hydroxyl-free radical exists within an acidic environment with sufficient nutrients, the growth of the Morgellons bacterial-like organisms, that's in italics, in that same medium will increase rapidly in the presence of oxidizers. That's a heck of a loaded statement. It took months to get to that. But if you take your time and start dissecting that statement as to what it means, it says that we have some knowledge, it appears, about the chemical and biological conditions that are supportive and or, and enhance the growth of this organism, quote unquote.
So an oxidative environment is encouraging for the growth of these organisms, or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, and the acidic part is a big part of it, too. Wine is actually
acidic,
quite acidic.
Oxidative, and you have the perfect medium so far, as we know.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I know that you know a lot on the health issue, so you'll probably pick this up right away, Jeff. But in terms of the essentials, that's it. The acidic environment appears as though the presence of the hydroxyl radical is extremely favorable, and in the addition of oxidizers in general, highly favorable to growth. You basically have an explosion that can take place. At the bacterial-like stage, remember, there are stages of this growth, and you cannot generalize to say that what you're talking about, the bacterial-like, is the same as what you would be dealing at the filament stage. But my work, again, is at the bacterial-like stage because that is the genesis of the structure from what I can see.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first half of this paper, of which we could talk about four pages on it, but we simply won't have the time. But at least it gets it out there in terms of, hey, we know something that looks like it enhances the growth of this. Now, on the flip side, the obvious thing that we want to know immediately, I know we're all clamoring for, but it's not easy because I can tell you, you can put this stuff in bleach directly and you can heat it up and whatever you want. It's not going to die. It may be dormant, but you're not killing it. But on the flip side, is there anything we can do that might suppress it?
Mm-hmm.
Many, many, many things have been tried. The old, you know, adage of somebody beating their head against the wall is there, and it's going to be there for us. But cutting to something which appears to be a potential benefit to us. Just as, and again, it's simply by pure logic, but if you have something which it grows well in an acidic, oxidative environment, might it not be beneficial if the environment becomes more alkaline, and might it not be beneficial if antioxidants were introduced into the medium? This is the logic of the question, and there is no final answer, but that approach has been pursued at the initial stages and with particular interest in the hydroxyl radical, which by the way, is like one of the most reactive things in the world. It's right after fluorine. It's amazing. This thing wants to react with anything that it can get its hands on. Because of that proposition, one would now begin to investigate, search for, and look for what are called hydroxyl scavengers. Okay. This is what you would look for. I've done my search on that, at least at the early stages. I have identified three of them that are candidates for my trials and works right now. The first is as ascorbate, or ascorbate, vitamin C, basically. The second is glycerin, glycerol, the same thing. And the third is what they call an ester salt. There's a fascinating pack. I have applied these in certain trials, and all I will say at this point is that there appear to be some encouraging results regarding the suppression of that extreme growth with the use of these antioxidants. And this paper focuses on questioning and evaluating the influence of alkalization of your diet and your life and the use of antioxidants.
Very
good.
This is what it focuses
on.
Very good. Clifford, stunning presentation as always. Thank you for all the work you do for all of us. And I mean that. And I'll be here the next time you're ready.
Thanks a whole lot, Jeff, for everything always. Appreciate it.
Indeed. Take care. All right, Clifford Carnicombe. He's a remarkable man. I think a lot of you learned a great deal tonight, especially those of you who are very much interested in the issue of what we call Morgellons, but it's so much more than that. All right, we'll be back in 21 hours. See you then.